content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jim Cronin from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall be reading to you from the Reader's Digest and Consumer Reports. And with that, let's start off with, and how about some true stories? Small changes and big improvements. Readers share the tiny tweaks they made to their daily lives and what happened as a result. And as soon as I can turn the page, we can do this. A real doll. I've worked at an amusement park, and when another barber joined the team, I changed my name tag from Barb to Barbie. It was funny to see how small kids related to me differently. Is she really Barbie? They asked. I changed it at my other job, too, and began answering the phone, "Hi, this is Barbie. How can I help you?" 90% of the callers now respond with my name. "Barbie, can you tell me?" Pronouncing that long E sound forces your mouth into a smile. But I found the smile is usually returned voluntarily. Barbie Bosco, Latrobe, Pennsylvania. Rice twice as nice. We replaced rice with cauliflower rice. There's not much of a difference in taste, and it seasons well, cooks in minutes, and is a vegetable instead of empty carbs. Michelle Bird, Bolton, New Jersey. By the way, Barbie was in Latrobe, Pennsylvania. The sweet life. I eat my dessert first. I am 95 years old. Paula Hassler in Tempe, Arizona. After all, you never know if you're going to be able to finish your dinner, right? Happy wife, happy life. Early in our marriage, my husband would come home exhausted from work, and I'd be exhausted from the kids. We were both tired and cranky, and we'd often end up arguing. I got to a point where I worried we were on the verge of a divorce. The day I realized it, I asked myself, am I the person I would want to come home to? I began greeting him with a smile and a kiss instead of complaining about my day. He'd smile back, and we'd talk calmly. We still have our differences, but one small change in attitude saved our marriage forever. Phyllis Verdemain, State College, Pennsylvania. Ahead of the times. We pre-sort silverware in the dishwasher. It takes no extra time loading and makes emptying much easier. We always smile when our kids, now adults, introduce friends to Spoonland and Forkland. That's from Catherine Luck at North Olmsted, Ohio. Creating a paperless trail. My sentimental hoarding results in countless envelopes stuffed with playbills, flyers, ticket stubs, wedding invitations, graduation announcements, holidays, and birthday cards. Sounds like my cologne. I placed all the contents on a scanner and laid coordinated decorative paper on for them for a background. Then uploaded the scans to a folder titled, Paula's Scrapbook. It felt great to clear so many excess papers and create a beautiful craft project. Memories to share on my computer. Paula M. Crane, Tucson, Arizona. Throwing in the towel. I raised 9 boys on a farm. It was their job to bring in the laundry downstairs. I spent a lot of time turning socks, underwears, and shirts right side out. So I stopped and just folded everything as it came out of the dryer. I never noticed the boys wearing their socks or shirts inside out. The underwear, I don't really know. RN via RD.com. What's the laziest thing you've ever done? Give the hardest job to the laziest person to find the easiest way to do it, said someone, somewhere, sometime, we guess. Sometimes a little lethargy is the prerequisite of a stroke of genius. Just ask the inventor of Lazy Susans. Too comfy to get up and hit the lights? Shine a laser pointer on the switch so the cat will jump up and swat it. We're talking that level of laziness. Or on the flip side, have you ever put off something for so long that it wound up working out in your favor? If you've done something so lazy it's almost admirable, please put forth the effort to share your story and see the terms at rd.com/lazy. And now something more serious, drama in real life. The impossible rescue. When 13 members of a Thai youth soccer team became trapped in a flooded cave, the two-week ordeal mesmerized the world. Here's your extraordinary story of how they were saved. And this is kind of current because there's actually a film coming out about this, which should be in theaters, I believe, early next month. Soccer practice for the Mupa, that's M-O-O-P-A, that's like the cow moo and the paw for papa, Wild Boars soccer team, had just ended when assistant coach Ekapul Chatawang, or E.K., suggested that he and the players take refuge from the simmering mid-afternoon heat by exploring the Tham Luang Cave. Ek, a boyish 25 and more big brother to the kids than drill sergeant, heard no complaints. The cave at the base of a mountain in northern Thailand was a favorite hangout. So that Saturday, June 23, 2018, at noon, the Mupa jumped on their bikes and rode the half hour to Tham Luang. Parking their bikes outside, they entered the cave, passing a sign that warned in large red letters in Thai and English that from July to November was flooding season in the cave. Kochak wasn't worried. It was June, and the monsoon rains that could flood the cave's channels were still weeks away. Behind him were 12 players who, like many Thais, went by nicknames. Knight 17, T-16, Noted Nick 15, Bu Adul and Turn 14, Dom Pong Nark and Mick 13, and Titan 11. The mouth of the cave was large enough to fit the Taj Mahal. Mud stains 20 feet up showed how high water marks of previous year's floods. Walking further into the cave, their way lit by flashlights, the team climbed over boulders, slid down steep slopes, and walked through puddles, ducked at those points where the ceiling was only a few feet high. About a mile in, they turned left at a T-junction and climbed down into a bowl-shaped recess. Their destination, Pattaya Beach, a sandbar named after a Thai resort area more than a third of a mile farther in. About 15 minutes later, they reached Pattaya Beach and stopped for a break. Titan experienced the cave for the first time, was creeped out by the dark and spooky shadows cast by their flashlights, but he didn't dare tell the older boys. Kochak checked his watch. They'd been in the cave about an hour. It was time to head back. But before they reached the T-junction, instead of the stagnant puddles they had crossed on the way in, they found deep, fast-moving water. Heck told the others he would check it out. He pulled a rope from his bag, tied it around his waist, and instructed three of the bigger boys to, if I yank twice, pull me back. If I don't, you can come. Eck dove down in the darkness, depth and current. Eck dove down, but the darkness, depth, and current defeated him. He yanked twice. Knight felt a surge of panic as he helped haul his coach back in. It was now late afternoon. The boys hadn't eaten in hours and were growing anxious. Afraid they would panic, Eck told them something he didn't believe himself, that the water would recede by morning. "You'll see," he said. "Why don't we find a place to sleep?" They retreated into the high sandbar of Pattaya Beach, which typically remained dry during floods. Eck led the boys in Buddhist prayers, chants, that he hoped would soothe them. As they lay down to sleep, the Mupa had no way of knowing that the monsoon rains had arrived early. "Where are the boys?" That night, when their sons hadn't arrived home, the boys' parents grew alarmed. At 10 p.m., a team of rescuers was called in, only to be turned away by rising water. A few parents made their way to the mouth of the cave. A ranger stopped them from going in. Instead, they shouted into the entrance, "Knight! Bu! Dom! Titan!" No response. The next day at 7 a.m., more rescuers entered the cave. Among them was Vern Unsworth, a 63-year-old local Brit who knew this post better than everyone. Over several expeditions, he had created an extensive survey of the cave system. At the T-junction, Unworth stopped in his tracks. The bowl he'd seen so many times was now completely underwater. He had been told that there was water, but he hadn't expected this much. There was nothing he could do but return to the mouth of the cave. While Unsworth was forced out of the cave because of the rising water, the boys were forced further in for the same reason. About a mile and a half from the entrance, the muddy ground slanted upward toward the cave wall, leading to a flatter area where they could sit and wait to be saved. They were cold, hungry, and scared. Whenever a boy started to cry, the others would hold him and try to cheer him up. They had no food, but the stream below gave them water. It wasn't much, but it would hold them, but it would be home for the next 2 weeks. "We've got something." Days passed, and still nobody knew where the boys were or whether they had survived. Royal Thai Navy SEALs, an elite fighting force, searched various passageways but had no luck finding them. 1,000 troops and would-be helpers gathered outside the cave, and the world watched live news reports, hoping for a miracle. But as the waters rose, the military suspended rescue attempts. One day, on day five, an expert in water management created a system of pipes and pumps to divert water from the seeping into the cave. It helped slow the deluge, but over the next few days, rescuers were still unable to find the boys. They simply didn't have the expertise. What was needed was seasoned spelunkers and the technical know-how to navigate the dark, fast-moving waters and climb the tricky passageway. On day 10, two of the world's best cave divers, Rick Stanton, 57, and John Volanthan, 48, both of Great Britain, arrived. They were Britain veterans of multiple cave rescues in which they had brought people out alive. More often, though, they found corpses. Still, there was a chance the boys were alive. Vern Unsworth sketched a map of the cave system for the Brits. It showed 9 distinct chambers, each problematic in its own way. The first two chambers made up a vast entrance. The third chamber featured a steep 45-degree slope pocked with boulders, stalagmites, and stalactites that needed to be negotiated. Chambers 4 through 8 were completely or partially flooded and extremely narrow, so narrow in parts that rescuers would have to take off their oxygen tanks to pass through. Chamber 9 was where Unsworth thought the boys might be. For 3 hours, Stanton and Volta swam against the current, breathing heavily in their regulators and carefully unspooling a thin guideline behind them, their link to the outside world. They were now deeper into Tham Lung Cave than any of the rescuers before them. Stanton checked his air gauge. He had used about a third of his supply, which was a signal to turn back soon. Cave divers use a third of a tank on the journey in, save a third for the journey out, and reserve in case of trouble, like getting lost or stuck. They passed Pattaya Beach, which water had swallowed up. Chamber 9, according to Unsworth's map, was a few hundred yards beyond. Along the way, any time that they noticed air pockets, they'd bob up and take a sniff, their noses supplying information their eyes couldn't. Before taking the mask off once again, Stanton made a motor note to tell Volton they should turn around, and then he sniffed. It was the thick smell of either human excrement or decaying bodies. "Hey, John," he said, "we've got something." Then they heard voices. As they drifted toward the sound, they saw a beam of light flicked on and slowly scanned the water. Moments earlier, Coach Eck had heard the men's voices. He asked everyone to hush. Too tired to move, Eck told Mick, who was holding their flashlight, to go to the water's edge to see if anyone was there. Mick complied and then froze in fear as he watched what looked like two alien creatures with hoses attached to their mouths and helmets, bristling with lights, surface from the water. The divers' headlights illuminated the Mupaw soccer players, temporarily blinding them. "How many are you?" shouted Volaton. 13, came the reply in English. "Brilliant," said Volton, relieved to hear they were all alive. "We are hungry," said the boys. They lifted their jersey to reveal bony rib cages. The divers had not expected to find the boys alive and had no food for them. Stanton took stock of the group. The little ones and the coach seemed lethargic and frail, but some of the bigger boys appeared surprisingly energetic. After 20 minutes, Volton made the difficult announcement that they would be leaving the team behind for the time being. It killed the divers that they couldn't rescue everyone then and there, but it was too dangerous at this point. "But many people are coming," Volton assured them. "When?" asked one desperate boy. "We hope tomorrow," Volton said, though he couldn't possibly be sure. He couldn't be sure of anything. He couldn't be sure how untrained rescuers would get through the flooded cave with food and provisions, and he certainly wasn't sure how to get the boys out alive. All he and Stanton could do now was to return to their base, within the help of others, devise a nearly impossible rescue plan. Before the two men dipped back into the water, each boy came over and wrapped skinny arms around them. "I am so happy," Adul told them. "We are happy, too," Volanton replied. In a country where physical contact among strangers is unusual, where hands pressed together in front of one's face make the place of a handshake, the embraces showed the enormity of the boys' relief and gratitude. The next day, 7 Thai SEALs, following the guidelines set up by Stanton and Volton, made the perilous journey into Chamber 9. They came bearing blankets, medical supplies, and food, the first the boys had tasted in nearly 2 weeks. Outside the cave, an American military pararescue unit, called in from a base in Okinawa, Japan, was placed in charge of rescue plan logistics. No one had ever attempted a rescue this tricky or this magnitude inside a flooded cave. There were no easy options. That meant every scheme, no matter how far-fetched, was on the table. The most obvious plan, having the boys swim out, was immediately scrapped. There were long underwater passages. If a boy panicked, then he and his rescuers could drown. One hotly debated proposal called for leaving the boys in the cave until the end of the monsoon season, 4 months away. Some argued they'd be safe there. Others insisted they'd go crazy inside that long. It all became moot when it was determined that there wasn't enough oxygen in the chamber for them to last that long. Another plan that met with initial skepticism was to sedate the boys and have rescuers swim them out. It sounded doable, but what if the kids woke up during transit? After bandying about other ideas, none that seemed workable, the team came back to the notion of sedation, and the more they talked it out, the more it came into focus. The linchpins of the rescue team would be two recently arrived Australian cavers, Richard Harris, an anesthesiologist, and his caving partner, Craig Challen. At dive time, Harris would administer 2 injections, ketamine to knock the boys out, and atropine to dry up their mouths and lungs so they wouldn't choke on saliva. The rescue, as devised, would require a dozen divers working in shifts over 3 days, Each would be assigned one boy to bring out. The divers would be given a pouch containing loaded syringes and taught how to administer the shot should the medication wear off in the passage. The plan also called for hundreds of air tanks to be hauled to points set up along the extraction route that divers could swap out for their emptied tanks. Flexible plastic stretchers called skids, which would wrap around each kid like a taco, were also dropped in Chamber 3. The boys would need to be put on them through the last treacherous stretch before the cave entrance. Despite the meticulous planning, the rescuers knew that casualties were a strong possibility. There were just too many things that could go wrong. A fact driven home when a volunteer ran out of oxygen and died while ferrying air tanks. Getting the boys out. At 10 a.m. on Sunday, July 8th, the lead divers, Harris Challenge, Stanton Volton, and two more Brits, Jason Mallison and Chris Jewell, slipped into the water at Chamber 3. Spaced a few minutes apart, medical staff would wait in this chamber for their return with the kids. The first boy out would be Note. Harrison administered the shots, and after Note faded into from consciousness, Harrison Mallison zip-tied his arms and legs to prevent them from getting entangled or injured, and strapped on a positive pressure face mask, which would feed air continuous to ensure the boy kept breathing while comatose. Harris tested the mask seal by dunking the boy's head into the water. Note stopped breathing, and an internal 30 seconds later, bubbles flowed from the side of his mask. He was exhaling. Good. With an oxygen tank now secured around Note's waist, Mallison gripped the two straps on the back of the boy's inflatable vest and started kicking, following the guideline. The first section was the longest, a continuous 20-minute, 350-yard swim. At the end was a choke point. Mallison had to contort Note's body to get him through. Note's head, facing down, inevitably struck unseen rocks. His bare feet dangled low and scraped the sharp rocks and gravel on the tunnel floor. But Mallison's mission wasn't necessarily to bring the boy out unscathed. It was to bring him out alive. His sole focus was the mask seal. If it became dislodged, the boy could drown. Soon after the two emerged in Chamber 8, Volathan arrived with the second boy, turned, followed 20 minutes later by Jewel with the third boy, Nick. Then one by one, each diver and boy entered the water-filled hollow at Chamber 7 and kept going. Back at Chamber 9, Harris dosed the day's last boy, Knight, with ketamine. For a few moments, he stopped breathing. Then a slow breath came. Stanton nosed the boy into the canal, watching carefully for bubbles that indicate breathing. 50 yards out, he shouted back to Harris. He doesn't seem to be breathing much. Knight was breathing nearly 3 times a minute. There's nothing we can do. Keep going, Harris shouted back. With four boys on their way out, Harris set off. Arriving in Chamber 8, he saw that Knight was looking well. He was blue and cold, barely breathing. Harris lay cheek to sand, cradling the boy's head, trying to keep his airway open and thinking, this is going really badly. But then Knight began to take sporadic steps of breath, and soon his breathing stabilized. In fact, he was coming too. Harris knocked him out with another ketamine jab. Stanton resumed their journey. Ahead of them, Mallison, the first diver, was leaving Chamber 7 when he felt Note twitch. He too was coming too. In neck-deep water, Mallison pinned Note against the wall while searching his bag for the syringe. I'm turning the page here. Unfortunately, my magazine is kind of crimpled here, so forgive me for a second here. When he found it, the syringes popped out and began slowly floating away. Mallison managed to grab one and injected Note's leg with more ketamine. The twitching subsided. The very last choke point was a drainpipe-sized vertical squeeze from Chamber 4 into Chamber 3, that went straight up, then straight down. It was the most challenging portion of the dive. Visibility was poor, and for the rescuers, feeling their way was even more difficult when holding both the guideline and the boy. Mallison pulled Note upright, stuffed him through the narrow opening, and slid in behind, careful not to let go. With the worst of the cave diving behind them, they arrived in Chamber 3, where the waiting medical staff descended on Note. One pair of rescuers flipped him onto his side. The boy was unresponsive. The doctor assessed his vitals. He's alive, came the call. Now some two-thirds of a mile more had to be covered to get Note out. First, he was strapped onto a skid, which was harnessed to a rope and pulley system rescuers had built in the last few days that would enable the boys to be lifted over a series of boulders. After that, the skid was carried about 70 yards by another team, climbing around and over stalagmites and boulders. Then Note's skid was attached to another rope system so that Thai SEALs could maneuver the stretcher down the 45-degree slope to a pararescuer who would carry the boy to Chamber 2. On the final stretch, another Thai SEAL team hauled Note through 400 yards of chest-high water and then ran him out of the cave, where Note was exposed to his first ray of natural light in more than 2 weeks. As the boys emerged, ambulances drove them to a waiting helicopter that flew them to a nearby hospital. The human shuttle continued for 2 days until the last boy, Pong, was pulled from the cave and delivered to the hospital. There he, his teammates, and their coach would remain under observation for the next week. Hours after Pong emerged, the monsoon rains totally sealed off Tham Luang Cave. Several weeks later, the boys rode their bikes up the hill to Coach X's home to celebrate Titan's 12th birthday. It was nearly 9 p.m., and when the boys cheerily bid Ek goodbye and pointed their bikes toward home, betraying not a trick of fear, they were, after all, the Mupa. And there's a picture of them, all of them here, and they're all lined up, and they're all different sizes, from fairly tall to actually kind of short and small. Interesting story. Happy thing. And it is going to be a movie, so it really ought to be good from everything they said here. Now on a totally different subject from the Reader's Digest, how to prevent your phone from overheating, which, considering how cold the weather is outside right now, right, it's 95s and 85s and such, it can be a concern. And we all need our phones, we know that. First of all, get sunblock for your phone. Probably the number one thing you can do is keep your phone away from heat sources. If you do insist on taking your phone to the pool, investing in a heat-resistant pouch or case could be worth the money to try and keep the phone cooler, suggests Sarah McConney, CEO of CellCell. Remember, phones are designed to shut down after they reach a certain temperature as a preventive measure to avoid too much damage. Use the right charger. Another way to avoid overheating is to use a charger from a reputable manufacturer that is compatible with your device. If you shouted over $1,000 for the newest Apple iPhone, I hope you shelled out for the $20 Apple Lighting USB cable, says tech expert Jezzer Nazari of TechSex. Nazari recommends using only official name-brand chargers that come with electronic device. Cheaply made chargers are usually not manufactured correctly and may have all types of issues, including exposing your phone to increased temperature, Nazari says. There are chips close to the plastic cover of a charger for a reason, and that reason is to help the heat escape easier. Often fake ones are poorly made with cheaper chips. Turn off Bluetooth. Turning off Bluetooth, especially if there's nothing to connect to, will prevent your phone from overheating too. If Bluetooth is on but the phone isn't connected to a device, it will constantly scan for something to connect to, says White. This could cause your phone to warm up. I didn't know that. That's interesting. Adjust your brightness. White also suggests turning down the screen brightness on your phone. Turning your screen brightness up will force your battery to work harder and create more heat, she says. Lower your screen brightness and consider shortening the screen timeout duration to keep your screen from being on it for unnecessarily long periods of time. Also look at anti-glare screen protector. It can help you see your phone screen in the sun, so you won't have to turn up the brightness. Now here is a critical item for food. Is eggplant a fruit or a vegetable? That's really important. Before you whip up some eggplant parm or baba ganoush, find out if eggplant as you're about to use is actually a fruit or a vegetable. From eggplant parm to stir-fry ratatouille, in its roasted vegetable, this delicious purple food is the star of many of our favorite dishes. We know it's tasty, and it's definitely one of our five a day, but there's a little confusion about how it should be classified. Namely, is an eggplant a fruit or a vegetable? The fruit-vegetable debate is a familiar one in the world of food facts trivia. If you already know where you stand on is the tomato a fruit or a vegetable discussion, then you're pretty sure that you know which nuts are nuts and which aren't. Wait, are peanuts actually nuts? Is cucumber a fruit or a vegetable? Is an avocado a fruit or a vegetable? Then you may have some assumptions about eggplants. But you know what they say about making assumptions, and the eggplant story is stranger than you might think. How did eggplants get their names? Eggplants are surprisingly complex. For one thing, they're not all purple. Other types of eggplants come in shades of white, green, red, and black. For another, they have different aliases depending on where you live. The eggplant is an ancient crop cultivated by humans all over the globe for hundreds of years and has as many names as you would expect for such a well-traveled plant. Here in the United States, it's called eggplant because of the first eggplants to arrive on these shores were the size, shape, and color of eggs. In some parts of the South, however, it is still known as the Guinea squash, because eggplants were brought from Guinea in West Africa in the 18th century. In the UK and parts of Europe, The eggplant is known by its French name, aubergine, which makes sense because British food names are never quite what we expect. For your information, aubergine is a version of the eggplant's ancient Arabic name, al-batajan. In India, al-batajan became brijnal. But when you call it aubergine, brijnal, eggplant, or dinner, it's nice to know what you're dealing with beyond its name. Which brings us to the question at hand, the reason we're here. Is eggplant a fruit or a vegetable? So, is eggplant a fruit? As always, it comes down to technicalities, like the whole cacao versus cocoa conversation. In this case, eggplants are considered fruits, or more specifically, berries. Yes, berries. Many fruits that come from a single flower, like eggplants, and even cucumbers and melons, are classified as berries. Eggplants count as, boy, I'll tell you, a watermelon would be a heck of a big berry. Eggplants count as vegetables only in one sense, the culinary. When we cook with eggplants, we treat them as vegetables, frying, grilling, baking, broiling, roasting, and mashing them to make tasty treats such as baba ganoush and moussaka. The humble eggplant is just another addition to the long list of fruits that we treat as vegetables, like peppers, zucchini, and pumpkins. Why is an eggplant considered a fruit? Eggplants are fruits due to the way they grow. Fruits develop from the flower of a plant and contain seeds, whereas vegetables are any other part of the plant. Roots, stems, or leaves. Eggplants belong to the nightshade family, which also includes tomatoes and potatoes. We should all be so lucky in our relatives. Like fruits and vegetables, eggplants are nutrient-dense, which is another way we know that they're in that five-a-day category. Some eggplants' benefits include being high in antioxidants, high in fiber at 3 grams per cup, which means they're good for your gut and they also help regulate your blood sugar. The gorgeous aubergine also has a reasonable amount of manganese, folate, potassium, and vitamins K and C. So add some to your shopping list right now for a healthy midweek dinner. Are all eggplants beautiful? No matter what type of eggplant you like to eat or what you choose to call it, it's safe to assume that we've settled the is an eggplant a fruit question once and for all. And from the slender Japanese eggplant to the purple and white striped zebra eggplant to the watermelon-colored Thai eggplant, they're all fruits. And they're all delicious, if you prepare them right. Air fryer eggplant fries are always the answer, in our opinion. In fact, if you get the right ingredients and assemble the right dessert, it's possible to have meal comprised entirely of fruits and no vegetables. And with that, let's switch over to Consumer Reports. And a note from the president, which is kind of strange, because this is the August edition of Consumer Reports, and yet this is something that I would think that the articles, I think, should have been out sometime in May or June. More travel, less worry. Over the next few months, millions of Americans will head off on vacation. While travel is a balm for the soul, it also presents challenges. Rising gas prices and other pressures of inflation, canceled flights, oh, that's a big thing right now, and evolving COVID-19 risk and protocols. That's why Consumer Reports pays close attention to your concerns. Whether making the road safer or the skies truly friendlier, our job is to get your trusted guidance and savings you deserve. Consumer Reports has long advocated for auto safety features, and our surveys show that how much consumers appreciate and value these technologies. 64% of you like your blind spot warning systems, for example. So we continue to work with companies to make more safety features standard on all vehicles. Safety should not be a luxury. We've also heard you tell us that the airline service has declined since the pandemic began. That's why CR organized consumers to call for a federal airline passenger bill of rights. It would set clear rules for how airlines must treat passengers, from compensating them for canceled flights to allowing families with young children to sit together without paying extra fees. CR is also committed to delivering actionable advice for improving your travel experience. Gone are the days when my father would hand over a $5 bill at the gas pump to get us where we needed to go. With gas prices at an all-time high, driving cross-country or even to a local beach might give you pause, which is why we publish tips on saving money at the gas pump. But cost isn't the only travel challenge, so this month's issue also offers expert advice on how to travel more safely and to plan for ever-changing circumstances. From consumer-powered advocacy to trusted practical advice, together we can create a marketplace that prioritizes consumers wherever they go. And that's from Marta L. Tolado, President and CEO of Consumer Reports. And our test revealed the best and safest sunscreens. Even though it's a little late in the season, it's never too late for sunscreens. And I got a whole bunch here, anywhere from Sunbum, which is scored a 67. La Roche Antihilas Melton Meek Lotion, which scored a 73. And Alba Botanical, which scored a 72. There's been a lot of news recently raising alarms about sunscreens. Last summer, several spray sunscreens were recalled after benzene, a known carcinogen, was detected in them. Other research has shown that some sunscreen ingredients can seep through your skin into your bloodstream, and the Food and Drug Administration has asked manufacturers for more data on their safety. And Hawaii has banned certain ingredients because of concerns that they may harm ocean reefs. With all that, you may be asking yourself whether sunscreen is still worth it. The short answer, absolutely. While those issues raise real concerns, at this point the risks are more theoretical than proven. Regular sunscreen use, on the other hand, clearly prevents skin cancers and saves lives. Some research suggests it can lower the risk of melanoma, the most serious type of skin cancer, by about 50%. In addition, there are smart choices you can make to ensure that the sunscreens you choose for you and your family are safe and effective, and may be better for the environment. To help that in effort, Consumer Report tested 52 sunscreens, identifying those that work best and those that don't protect you as well. We also tested every spray sunscreen in our ratings for benzene. All were free of the harmful chemical. We also delved into the research and talked with experts to understand the potential health and environmental risk posed by some sunscreen ingredients. Here are the answers to those questions. Are some sunscreens safer than others? Recent research has raised some concern about so-called chemical sunscreens, those that use one or more dozen chemical ingredients approved for use in the U.S. to filter the sun's damaging ultraviolet rays. In 2019, the FDA announced that it wanted more information on the safety of those ingredients, including whether they are absorbed systemically through the skin into the bloodstream. That's in part because Americans are now using a lot more sunscreen than in the past, and because today's products contain more combinations and higher concentrations of the ingredients. Soon after, FDA scientists published studies showing that six common chemical ingredients, avobenzone, homosalate, octinoxate, octosalate, octocrylene, and oxybenzone, do indeed get into the bloodstream. The FDA stresses that absorption doesn't mean these ingredients are unsafe, but the amounts absorbed were higher than the level the FDA... are higher than said would exempt them from safety testing, so more research is needed. Kathleen Suozzi, MD, Assistant Professor of Dermatology at the Yale School of Medicine, says the key question is whether that systemic absorption actually causes harm. Definitive answers may be years away. Generating the type of information the FDA desires is tough, time-consuming, and very expensive, says Mark Chandler, president of Act Solutions, which consults with Sungreen and other cosmetic manufacturers on product formulation. So should I stop using chemical sunscreens? The FDA, the American Academy of Dermatology, and independent researchers say there's no need for people to do that now. These UV filters have been used for years by millions of people, and there have not been any noticeable systemic effects, says Henry W. Lim, MD, a leading sunscreen researcher and former chair of the Department of Dermatology at Henry Ford Health in Michigan, who has also consulted with sunscreen makers. I still feel very comfortable saying that there are safe ways to prevent skin cancer and other damage from the sun. That said, some of those chemicals may be more worrisome than others. Oxybenzone and, to a lesser extent, octinoxate have emerged as the biggest concern, Lim says. That's primarily because preliminary research in animals suggest oxybenzone might interfere with hormone production, which theoretically could affect fertility, puberty, and thyroid function. However, sunscreen research that has been done in humans hasn't raised any major concerns. For example, while a 2020 review of 29 studies that looked at the health effects of oxybenzone and octinoxate said more research was needed, it also did not identify any links to any health problems. Still, to play it safe, the American Academy of Pediatrics recommends that parents not use oxybenzone-containing sunscreens on children, and people of any age who want to avoid sunscreens with either of those chemicals can easily do so, because manufacturers are now using them less often. In fact, of the 52 sunscreens on our rating, only three contain oxybenzone and none have octinoxate. Why not opt for a mineral sunscreen instead? It's true that sunscreens with minerals, titanium dioxide, and zinc oxide, which work by creating a physical barrier on your skin, aren't absorbed into the skin and don't make their way into the bloodstream. Unfortunately, those mineral sunscreens may not be as effective compared with the most efficient chemical filters, according to Chandler at the Sunscreen Formulation Company. All of the mineral sunscreens CR has ever tested appear in the middle bottom of our ratings. One possible reason, it takes a lot of titanium or zinc to create a product with a high SPF, Chandler says, and it's difficult to do that without making the sunscreen thick, gloppy, and hard to rub in. In addition, the minerals sometimes clump up in the product, so they don't get evenly dispersed on the skin, leaving potential gaps in protection. They can also wipe off more easily than chemical sunscreens, making free reapplication even more important, says Suozzi at Yale. For the best perfection, apply indoors. Put sunscreen on 15 to 30 minutes before heading out to give it a chance to start working before the UV rays hit you. Use enough lotion. In a bathing suit, use a shot-sized glass amount of sunscreen to cover your whole body. If you're mostly clothed, use a teaspoon on each arm or leg or other exposed body part. Spray safely. Spray into your hand and rub into your body, or hold the nozzle an inch from your skin and spray until your skin glistens, then rub it in. Don't forget these spots: ears, upper back, backs of hands and knees, and tops of feet, and swipe on a lip balm with SPF. Reapply. Put on more every 2 hours, you're outside, and right after swimming or sweating. If you do prefer mineral sunscreens, we suggest California Kids Super Sensitive Tinted Lotion SP 30+, or Badger After Minicle Cream SPF 30 Unscented. They were the highest scoring mineral sunscreens we tested, though both still rank well below the top performing chemical sunscreens. Are reef-safe products better for the environment? Some research suggests that oxybenzone and octinoxate may threaten coral or ocean reefs and harm other marine life. So far, that connection has primarily been studied at very high doses and in the lab, not in the real world. And in research looking at sunscreen chemicals in ocean water, the amount detected, even at popular beaches, are far below the levels linked to damage in lab studies. Still, the potential concern has prompted Hawaii, the U.S. Virgin Islands, and some other locations to ban sunscreens with either ingredient. And some sunscreen manufacturers now label their products as reef-safe. In most cases, the term is used when a product doesn't have either oxybenzone or octinoxate. But the FDA does not regulate the term, so it has no defined meaning. So if you want a product without oxybenzone or octinoxate, your best bet is to check the ingredients list. Does a spray or lotion work better? Used correctly, both can do a good job. In fact, the highest-rated product in our rating is a spray, Trader Joe's Spray SPS 50+. But sprays can be tricky to apply. The droplets can disperse into the air, making it easy to miss areas on your skin, Lim says. To avoid that, spray sunscreen on the palm of your hand, then rub it in. The next breath is to hold the nozzle just an inch from your skin, spray until you can see a film on your skin, and then rub it in. Also take care to make sure you don't inhale the spray, because the ingredients may irritate or even harm your lungs. For that reason, CR's experts say it's best not to use sprays on kids. Spraying it into your hand, that helps prevent inhalation. Never spray directly into your face, and be careful using sprays when it's windy. The spray can blow into your face and mouth, or disperse and not adequately cover your skin. Can I skip sunscreen if I cover up? Not entirely. You still need it on exposed skin. Experts point to enormous amounts of research linking sun exposure to about 90% of skin cancers and the proven effectiveness of sunscreen in blocking cancer-causing UV rays. The adverse effects of the sun exposure are well established, says Lynn. There is strong evidence that sunscreens help prevent skin cancer. However, covering up means you can use far less sunscreen. For example, if you wear a long-sleeved swim shirt or rash guard instead of a traditional bathing suit, you won't need to apply sunscreen to your arms, back, and chest. That can reduce the amount of sunscreen you need to use on your body, and that may get into your skin or into the ocean. Dermatologists say that sunscreen should never be your only defense against UV rays. Try to avoid the sun at its strongest between 10 a.m. and 4 p.m. And when you're outside, especially during those hours, cover up, wear a broad-brimmed hat, and seek shade when possible. Are safer, more effective sunscreens coming? Concerns about sunscreen ingredients being absorbed through the skin into the bloodstream have prompted some researchers to look for alternatives, says Christopher Bunnick, M.D., associate professor of dermatology at the Yale School of Medicine. Researchers there, for example, are exploring formulas that encapsulate chemical sunscreen ingredients, which will keep them on top of the skin and provide protection without being absorbed. Innovations are coming for mineral sunscreens, too. We're working with spherical silica particles and combining them with zinc oxide, says Chandler. The UV light goes into the spheres and gets bounced around and deflected. Not only does it make products go on more smoothly, but in some formulas they're able to double the SPF without adding more zinc. It's also possible that some of the sunscreen ingredients used in Europe and Canada will be approved for use here. Some of those are more effective UVA filters than we currently have, and they should have less penetration into the skin, Lim says. A few are currently stuck in the FDA approval process, so this is a glimmer of hope that we might eventually see them used in sunscreens in the U.S., Lim says. Is there benzene in your sunscreen? Millions of products have been recalled in the past year because of concern about this known carcinogen. Here's what you need to know. Last spring, a small Connecticut lab called Valsure announced that it had found benzene, a known carcinogen, in Neutrogena spray sunscreens. The findings prompted Johnson & Johnson, which makes the sunscreen, to recall affected products, and the Food and Drug Administration told manufacturers of other aerosol personal care products to test for the chemical, too. Many found it. To date, at least 15 brands have been affected, with more than 25 million products recalled because of contamination with the chemical. That includes other aerosol sunscreens such as Aveeno and Coppertone deodorants from Old Spice and Secret, and spray conditioners and shampoos from Aussie and Pantene. The recalls also prompted Consumer Reports to look into benzene in every aerosol sunscreen on our ratings, as well as several top-rated spray insect repellents. In addition, CR tested current versions of some other sunscreens that had been previously recalled, including from Johnson & Johnson, as well as from one from Coppertone and for the chemical. All of the sunscreens and insect repellents that CR tested came back negative for benzene, but other products continued recalled for it. Most recently, two types of Suave aerosol antiperspirants made by Unilever were recalled in March after they were found to contain benzene. What's going on, and how concerned should you be? Long-term risks. Since Valisher found benzene in sunscreens, the FDA has been trying to figure out why the chemical is showing up in so many products. So far, the agency has no clear answers because benzene is not an ingredient in the products. This contamination may be related to inactive ingredients such as carbomers, thickening agents, isobutane, a spray propellant, or other drug components made from hydrocarbons, says the FDA in December. What is clear is that while the amounts of benzene found in the products aren't high enough to pose immediate health threats, they do raise safety concerns. That's especially true when people are exposed to benzene for long periods or from other sources. The FDA says benzene levels in consumer products should be less than 2 parts per million. Frequent exposure to amounts above that could increase the risk of leukemia. Some of the recalled products had benzene levels well above that amount. For example, the recalled Aveeno and Neutrogena sunscreens had benzene levels ranging from 11.2 to 23.6 parts per million, 5 to 12 times above the level advised by the FDA. Even at those levels, benzene is unlikely to cause immediate serious health problems, says David Eastman, a toxicologist and professor emeritus at the University of California, Riverside, who has extensively studied benzene. But he and other health experts worry about the risk posed by repeated exposure, especially because people are also exposed to benzene from other sources, notably cigarette smoke and fumes at the gas pump. And it's combined exposure from multiple sources that poses the biggest health risk, he says. For those reasons, he underscores the importance of avoiding it when you can. What should you do? Concerns about benzene possibly being in some products should not be a reason to avoid using sunscreen. The products are essential to protecting against skin cancer and other skin damage. Instead, use CR's ratings to find an effective one. And be reassured that benzene was not detected in any of the aerosols we tested, including Trader Joe's Spray SPF 50+, the highest rated product in our ratings, or chose a highly rated sunscreen lotion or cream because benzene has not been linked to those kinds of products. To see whether you have a recalled sunscreen spray or other silver product, go to or in your home, go to cr.org/benzene. If you have one, throw it away right now. How to read that label. Sunscreen body and face. Mineral SPF 100. Broad spectrum. Reef safe. Water resistant. Mineral. These sunscreens have titanium dioxide, zinc oxide, or both. They sit on the skin surface and, unlike chemical active ingredients, aren't absorbed into blood, though they tend to be less effective. Reef safe. You often see this on mineral sunscreens or those without oxybenzone, but there's no standardized meaning beyond this or similar claims. For babies, FDA doesn't make a distinction between sunscreens for babies or children and those for adults. They all contain the same active ingredients and must meet the same criteria for safety and effectiveness. Dermatologists test it. This isn't a regulated term, so you don't know what the product was tested for or how extensive the testing was. SPF 100. You might think SPF 100 provides twice as much protection as an SPF 50, but that's not the case. SPF 100 blocks 99% of the sun's burning UVB rays. SPF 50 blocks 98% of the UVB rays, and SPF 30 blocks 97%. Broad spectrum. This means the sunscreen protects against UVA rays, which are responsible for skin cancer and aging skin, as well as UVB rays, which are mostly responsible for sunburn and contribute to skin cancer. Water resistant. This sunscreen will remain effective for the time stated, either 40 or 80 minutes when you're swimming or sweating, but you still need to reapply once you get out of the water. No oxybenzone. This chemical UV filter is often flagged as being potential harm to ocean life. Many sunscreens have been reformulated to remove it. All the sunscreens listed below have a stated SPF of at least 30, the minimum recommended by experts. All have water-resistant claims of 80 minutes unless otherwise noted. And the top rating for lotions of chemical with active ingredients is La Roche-Posay Anthios Melt-In Milk Lotion, scored a 73. It's $37. Cost per ounce is $7.40. The Equate Walmart Equa Ultra Lotion SPS 50 scored a 68. It's only $5 or 63 cents per ounce. Kiehl's Activated Sun Protection SPF 30 cost $32 and at $6.40 an ounce. Equate from Walmart Sport Lotion SPS 50 cost $4 and it's only 50 cents an ounce. Then the following are the next ones down the line. They're all in the 50s. Salomo from Amazon, Banana Boat, Up and Up Target, Black Green Sunscreen, Neutrogena, Hawaiian Tropic, Panama Jack, and Banana Boat and Australian Gold. And then the funds that don't get very good ratings are Roche-Posay Analithios, Clear Skin Phase Lotion of 60, Walgreens Sports Lotion SPS Freshly Fresh Scent, Hawaiian Tropic Matte Effect, and Black Girl Sunscreen Lotion SPF 50, all scored very low. For sprays, Trader Joe's SPF 50 at $6 for a container, $1 an ounce, got the highest rating of 74. Alba Botanica Hawaiian Coconut Clear Spray of SPS 50 is got a 72. It's $9.50 for a bottle, $1.58 an ounce. And Sunbum Spray SPS 50, $16 and $2.67 an ounce. And then the rest of these all got nice 60s. Australian Gold Ultra Hydration, Equate Sports Spray SPS 50 from Walmart, La Roche-Posay Antithelos Lotion Spray SPF 60, Up and Up Target Sport Spray SPS 50, Banana Boat Sport Ultra Spray SPF 100. That's $11.50, $1.92 an ounce. Lotions and sprays with mineral active ingredients are California Kids Super Sensitive Tinted Lotion SPF 30. And by the way, these only got in the 50s. Badger Active Minigal Cream, Alba Botanica, Aveeno Positively Mineral, Neutrogena Pure and Free Baby Lotion, Badger Kids Mineral Cream, and Aveeno Positive Mineral Sensitive Face Things. And these all range from anywhere from $8.28 an ounce down to about $2.67 an ounce. So they're not very cheap, and they're also not very effective. So you might want to be very careful about using the lotions and sprays with mineral and active ingredients. And here's some hints on how to get ready for a road trip. After 2 years of hunkering down, Americans are headed out on the open road. An overwhelming majority, 90%, have travel plans for this summer, says research from Destination Analysis. Many are also going to drive despite high gas prices. If you're looking forward to a road trip, we've got tips here to help you save money, stay safe, and manage unexpected hurdles. Before you go, make sure your vehicle is ready for a road trip. Start with the tires, including the spare, if your car has one. Check the pressure and inspect the tread, looking for visible signs of damage and wear. Top off windshield wiper fluid and replace your wiper blades if they're at least 6 months old. For other checks, consider going to a shop you trust, especially if your car hasn't been serviced in more than a year, says John Ebbetson, CR's chief mechanic. Have technicians inspect accessory belts and hoses. They can have life sprains as short as 5 years or 50,000 miles. Ask them to check oil, coolant, and power steering and brake fluid for proper levels and potential contamination. road trip to-dos, car emergency kit. Take jumper cables, a flashlight, duct tape, basic tools, and a tire gauge. A portable jump starter can help juice up your phone and car. Packing. If your car has cargo tie-down anchors, use them to secure heavy items. Don't let luggage block the driver's view, either. Roof and bike racks. After installing, double-check your work by driving for a few minutes with the rack empty. Pull over and make sure rack is well secured. Internet. If your car has a built-in Wi-Fi hotspot, consider enabling it for a month so that all passengers can use their devices. Pets. For your safety and theirs, pets should be a crate or secured seat harness with padded straps. If needed, you can find accredited animal hospitals en route at AAHA.org. First aid and other supplies. Pack bandages, something that can be used as a tourniquet, and a pain reliever, plus an N95 mask, rapid COVID-19 antigen test, and hand sanitizer, of course. Tolls. Some states no longer accept cash. Plan your route and sign up for the toll transponder for transponders you'll need, such as Easy Pass. The tolls might be discounted, and it's easier than paying toll bills later by mail. Car seats. Almost half of all child car seats are improperly installed. Go to crt.safekids.org to find out more about safe installation. Make the most of your trip. We have some fresh ideas for you, from how to find cool motels off the beaten path to how to create the ultimate road trip playlist. Eat like a local. Once at your destination, search online for restaurant reviews. You can also go to specialty websites such as Eater, where locals discuss favorite food spots. It's a good idea to ask a shop owner or staffers at your hotel for lunch or dinner recommendations. This way you'll find hidden gems that aren't in the guidebooks, such as an unassuming roadside diners, food trucks, and barbecue joints where you might otherwise pass by. Head for history. The National Register of Historic Places, nps.gov/subjects/National Register, and other websites list culturally significant places. See modern architecture gems from the likes of your Eros Arena in Columbus, Indiana. Dine at the historic Magnolia House in Greensboro, North Carolina, one of the few places between Atlanta and Richmond that allowed black guests during the Jim Crow era. Drive, bike, and hike stretches of Oregon's scenic Columbia River Highway. Be smart about points. Many travel rewards programs extend their expiration dates during the first months and years of the pandemic. Some of those extensions have ended, so check the expiration dates on your various credit card, hotel, and other travel points programs to see your account status. You might be surprised to find points you've forgotten about. Maybe you have enough to swing a free hotel night or an upgrade. Book a room with a vibe. Tired of cookie-cutter chain hotels? Many old-fashioned motor coach hotels are being lovely rehabbed to transfer you straight back to the 50s. Blending retro charm with modern amenities, think redone rooms with walk-in showers. Mixed with mid-century styling, many have pools, fire pits, and even spas. You can find photos and info at the Hip Lodge, hiplodge.com. I wonder if they still have those vibrating beds you put a quarter in and they shook like crazy. That shows my age. Create a road trip soundtrack. Want to know which songs will be on repeat when you get to your destination? Apple Music City charts can tell you the most listened to songs in over 100 places across the country. And some tourism boards have curated pair lists designed to capture the feel of a place. They are playlists for Nashville, Tennessee, and New Orleans, and of course. But did you know you can download songs that caption the essence of New York's Finger Lakes? See some sights. Big crowds are expected at national parks and other popular spots this summer, but you can often find breathtaking alternatives nearby. For example, if you can't get to peak hours reservation for California's Yosemite National Park, you can search by state at the National Park Service website, nps.gov, and find another option about 90 minutes away, Devil's Post Pile National Monument, and it's a 100-foot rainbow falls, and they have a picture of it. It's a beautiful falls. Ways to fill up for less. Use a credit card with strong cash back benefits for gas. The best ones currently offer up to 5%, beating many gas station branded cards, and can save $3 to $5 on a 15-gallon fill-up. Gas is often cheaper at Costco if you're a member, and the gas meets their top-tier quality standard. Plus, you can save even more if you pay with a Costco Visa cash back card. Find low-cost gas with Google Maps and Waze app, or check the Gas Buddy website. Be sure to read privacy and terms or use disclosures before using apps to ensure you're comfortable with the type of information they collect. Retailer rewards programs such as Walmart and Kroger fuel points and apps like Upside can give you cash or points on gas purchases. Again, read any terms and conditions carefully. How about we close out today with a little bit of word power? Roll out the red carpet, prepare to be tickled pink. These vocabulary words are all related to color. Will you win the blue ribbon or wave the white flag? Head over the rainbow for the next page for the answers, which we shall do. The first one is sanguine. That's S-A-N-G-U-I-N-E. Is that canary yellow, blood red, or lime red? It's blood red. Smoke from wildfires can give the sun a sanguine hue, even thousands of miles away. Blanch. Become pale, feel blue, or black out. Become pale. Chase blanched when she saw the rattlesnake. Ombre, O-M-B-R-E apostrophe E. Tie-dyed, bronze-plated, graduated in tone. Graduated in tone. Should I get ombre highlights in my hair or dye it all blonde? Wouldn't take much. I don't have much hair. Alabaster, white mineral, copper coin, or violet gemstone. That's a white mineral. The museum has a large collection of alabaster statues. Variegated. Is that striped, camouflage, or multicolored? It's multicolored. Margot's variegated outfit raised eyebrows at the funeral. Brindled. And what is that's tanned, having dark spots, or rose-tinted? That's having dark spots. We adopted two kittens today. Dot is brindled, and Marmalade is orange. Cerulean. Is that sky blue, royal purple, or hot pink? It's sky blue. Known for its cerulean waters and white sand beaches, the island is a top tourist destination. Monochromatic. Is that color-coded, silver, or having one hue? That's having one hue. The artist's early work was gloomy and monochromatic, but her later canvases are bright and colorful. Imbue. Is that fade over time, glow red, or dye deeply? That's dye deeply. The setting sun imbued the sky with streaks of fuchsia. And sepia. Brown, peach, or lavender? Brown. Becca uses a sepia Instagram filler to give her photos the vintage look. And with that, we've just about run out of time for today's episode of the Reader's Digest and Consumer Reports. Be sure to listen in next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. I'm Jim Cronin, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. So long until next week, and thanks so very much for listening.